Welcome to Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we mark the celebration of Thanksgiving with the last in our year-long series of interviews which explored the history of the nation's major civic holidays. Our special guest is Matthew Dennis, professor of history at the University of Oregon and the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, An American Calendar. Kelly Schrum will follow up on my conversation with Matthew Dennis with another of her sites of the week, this one on the Pilgrims. And after that, we'll begin another special series. Michael Farquhar will offer up the first in a 10-part series drawn from his new book, A Treasury of Deceptions, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. The title tells it all, and we trust you'll find the series both entertaining and enlightening. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at some items of historical interest in the news. As a follow-up to an interview we aired only last week with John Barry on the pandemic of 1918, various news sources report that scientists have mapped the genetic sequence of the influenza that caused that deadly epidemic. The discoveries could help researchers predict which new strains of flu virus would cause future pandemics and could also help them develop drugs and vaccines to treat those strains. The 1918 flu pandemic, you may recall from our conversation with Barry, killed millions of people worldwide, including over 600,000 Americans. A strain of avian influenza now circulating in Asia has some scientists and government officials fearing another possible pandemic. The disease has claimed millions of birds, and it has infected more than 100 people, killing about half of them. So far, it does not seem to be easily transmitted from person to person, which was the case in 1918. And a recent request made by President George W. Bush to Congress included a reference to a little-known bit of history, the Posse Comitatus Act, that has sent people scurrying to find out more about it. One of the best accounts of its history appeared on the History News Network. It was researched by Dana Somerville, an HNN intern, and a journalism and history major at Michigan State University. President Bush made reference to the Posse Comitatus Act in his request of Congress that it allow the military to assume police functions in the event of national emergencies, like Hurricane Katrina. Somerville explained that the phrase in Latin means power of the country, and that originally, in 15th century England, it referred to a sheriff's common law authority to arrange citizens into a posse in order to enforce laws. In the United States, however, it came to refer to the military enforcement of civilian law, something of which Americans were leery from the start. The particular act to which President Bush referred was passed on 1878 in the wake of the Civil War and Reconstruction, during which time U.S. soldiers were used to enforce federal laws in what had been rebel territories and to protect the newly won rights of black freedmen. It resulted from a compromise, Somerville found, that resolved the conflict over the presidential election of 1876, which ended Reconstruction and led to the removal of federal troops from the South. When we return, I explore the history of Thanksgiving with Matthew Dennis. This is Talking History. This week we celebrate Thanksgiving, Americans' most loved holiday, writes our guest. He's Matthew Dennis, the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, An American Calendar. Matthew joins us for the final time in our year-long series of programs on the nation's civic holidays. Matthew is also a professor of history at the University of Oregon. Welcome back, Matthew.
Nice to be here.
You describe Thanksgiving as an autumn festival with charm, beauty, and nearly universal appeal.
Well, to that extent, as so many countries have similar fall festivals, and because there's a historical connection between the harvest and what is generally seen as the first Thanksgiving in America, is Thanksgiving in the United States much like harvest festivals around the world?
Well, it's evolved over time, certainly, and there's a real American stamp to it, but it does share a lot with other harvest festivals all over the world. You know, many societies take time out from their regular schedules to think about what they have and to express a certain thanks for it. Even in our modern world, we're still tied to a certain degree to the seasons and to an agricultural calendar. It doesn't have a great impact on most Americans' lives today, but there's an important kind of residual presence of that, I think. And so I guess it's a waffling answer that, yes, it's like a lot of others, but it's a lot different as well.
Okay. Let's cover the basics here just to be sure. What historical event is Thanksgiving supposed to memorialize?
It's supposed to memorialize the successful completion of a year and a harvest in the Plymouth Colony in 1621. You know, the famous Pilgrims had set sail in 1620. They ended up right near Cape Cod in Massachusetts, founding Plymouth Colony in 1620. They came late. They came in December. And they endured a difficult winter in which many, many died. It was very difficult to survive, but they were able to do so in part because they were helped by native people living in the region. They managed to hang on through the spring, put in a crop, harvest it, and survive. And so at that point, the governor called a day of Thanksgiving to celebrate the event. We don't really have much actual evidence of what happened in the historical record. The best piece we have is in a letter sent from New England from a friend in which that correspondent writes, "Our harvest being gotten in, our governor sent 4 men on fowling that we might, after a more special manner, rejoice together after we had gathered the fruits of our labors." So it was a harvest festival meant to replicate in its own more primitive way the kind of harvest home festivals that would have been conducted back home in England.
Now, when we did our interview a couple months back, when we did Columbus Day, one of the things you talked about was not letting the facts get in the way, how historians tend to ruin things, rain on people's parade. When we talk about the first Thanksgiving and the Pilgrims, very often we use the phrase thereafter in terms of saying on the Mayflowers, if that's the very beginning. And many people associate the first Thanksgiving with the very beginning of this nation. Yet it was by no means the first settlement in America in 1620, not even the first British settlement in America. Jamestown preceded by some 13 years. Why do we focus on the first Thanksgiving at Plymouth?
Well, probably the greatest reason we do is because the holiday of Thanksgiving that we know today was really a Victorian invention. It has its roots in 17th and especially 18th century New England, but the way we celebrate it, the way we remember it, the way it fits into American culture is in the way that it emerged in the middle of the 19th century. And at that point, what we see is the cultural dominance of New England. In a way, it's a representation of a local or regional festival as an American festival. And, you know, we see this a lot, where kind of local history becomes American history. And this is clearly what occurs at this point. Also, I think it's the case that with the Civil War, we see the culture of the South lose some credibility nationally. So an alternative, say, celebration of Jamestown and the John Smith and Pocahontas tales, for example, wouldn't have the same kind of traction that a northern tale would have. And then finally, I think the Thanksgiving story, the story of the Pilgrims going to a new place as immigrants, as surviving and prospering to the extent that they could then thank God for their abundance, that's a very useful trope or symbol in American society. We see it used over and over. If the Pilgrims were understood as the first comers, late comers, immigrants, not just from England, but from Europe and Asia and elsewhere, could make the same case that they too were latter-day Pilgrims.
Let me pick up on the point you made earlier. Would it be safe to say then, with much of what people associate today with Thanksgiving, whether they're sitting down at the table and eating or whatever they do as a ritual, is a Victorian celebration rather than a 17th century Pilgrim Puritan celebration?
Yeah, it's different from, say, what we know of the first Thanksgiving. The first Thanksgiving was a three-day feast, a kind of festival that didn't have a set meal. People ate when they were hungry. Food was cooking all the time. It was punctuated by all sorts of games and revelry. It wasn't a particularly pious event. If it had been a fast instead of a feast, it would have, but it didn't have that kind of piety or religious flavor. What we see emerging Victorian times is a set meal that includes family gathered together and friends or community members gathered at one particular table, a particular prescribed meal featuring turkey at its center. You know, all of those things emerged in the middle of the 19th century.
But still no football.
That would not be too far off. By the 1870s, American football was becoming more important, and the first league was founded by four Ivy League schools. By the 1880s, one of the great sporting events in the United States was the national championship football game staged in New York City on Thanksgiving Day. You know, at that point, there weren't a lot of schools competing, but that became a huge social event and would continue to grow. Certain teams would play each other traditionally on Thanksgiving, and by the 1930s, the emergence of the professional football league, the NFL, we see the Lions begin to stage a Thanksgiving Day game in Detroit and on radio. That tradition continues. In some ways, then, this athletic component to Thanksgiving has become really important, and it, in some ways, is very consistent with the first Thanksgiving, strangely enough.
Did they play any games at the first Thanksgiving?
Well, they had shooting contests, races. You know, it's hard to know exactly. We can speculate about what they did based on the sorts of ways that harvest festivals were celebrated, but it's shooting contests and leaping contests, the sorts of things that they would do for amusement.
Male things, I understand. And they had guests. They had Native Americans there.
Well, there are more Indians than pilgrims. The settlement was quite depleted. There are many deaths during the course of the winter. Native people in the region also had been decimated by epidemic diseases that had preceded the so-called pilgrims and reduced their population quite dramatically, changing the geopolitical situation of southern New England dramatically. So the Wampanoags, led by Chief Massasoit, was in a difficult position. In some ways, then, the arrival of the Plymouth colonists could provide him with new allies. And he was very helpful to this fledgling settlement. So when the first Thanksgiving was held, there were probably twice as many Native people there as English colonists, and it's likely as well that they provided much of the food, at least the venison, that would have been a central feature of the first Thanksgiving.
I used to work with a fellow historian who I was quite fond of, who used to quote Mr. Dooley all the time. So when I read your quote, I just had to bring it into the conversation here. And he's, of course, the humorist Finley Peter Dunne. But you quote him, "Thanksgiving, 'twas founded by the Puritans to give thanks from being preserved from the Indians." Forgive the failed attempt at pronouncing Irish here, but what's that quote about in your mind?
Well, it continues. It says, "It was founded by the Puritans to give thanks for being preserved from the Indians, and we keep it to give thanks we are preserved from the Puritans." So there's some funny components to it, certainly, because here we have these Puritans being associated with the Indians. It suggests that immigrants who came to America around the turn of the 20th century, or even earlier, certainly, were coming to a kind of wilderness populated by scalpers, not native people who took trophies in that way, but people who are going to try to steal what few possessions that immigrants had and exploit them however possible, that they were coming into an American wilderness themselves and that they were trying to survive, not necessarily with the help of those who were already there, but in spite of them.
You mentioned two names in particular that have a lot to do with actually establishing the holiday, Sarah Hale and President Lincoln. How did they figure into this?
Well, Sarah Josepha Hale might be seen as the founding mother of Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving, of course, was an important regional festival in the fall in New England. She was a New Englander, and increasingly promoted it as she became more prominent in writing and publishing. She was the longtime editor of a very important ladies' magazine, Godey's Ladies' Book, and each fall she would promote Thanksgiving to the rest of the country. She wrote a book in 1827 called Norwood, and in it she wrote, "We have too few holidays. Thanksgiving, like the 4th of July, should be a national festival observed by all the people as an exponent of our republican institutions." So it was, in a way, a means of teaching Americans republicanism and making new Americans more American and binding the whole nation together, building a kind of nationalism. That would continue, and Sarah Hale would promote it throughout the 19th century, writing letters to each governor of each state saying you should observe it in your individual state, and promoting it with each subsequent president. By 1863, during the course of the Civil War, President Lincoln ultimately issued a proclamation declaring a national Thanksgiving. It's interesting that in some ways we can see in that presidential proclamation a kind of anticipation of some of the things that Lincoln would say in his second inaugural address shortly before he was assassinated. He hoped during the course of the Civil War that Thanksgiving might be a means of helping the different sections reconcile, in a way to move beyond the current turmoil and contention, to go back to an earlier time where things were more peaceful, where there was a kind of common heritage. He fervently implored the imposition of the almighty hand of God to heal the wounds of the nation and to restore it as soon as may be consistent with divine purposes, to full enjoyment of peace, harmony, tranquility, and union. And we'd see then after the Civil War as well, Thanksgiving could be a means of national reconciliation. It could be a rite of reunion as different states in the different sections of the country could celebrate the same day and again kind of leap over the problems of their recent past in order to find something in common in their more distant history.
Okay, so he had other reasons than just being badgered by Sarah Hale to make this proclamation.
Yeah, and it had some precedent because it had been celebrated in many different states before the Civil War and during the Civil War, even in the South, although it did have the taint of being a kind of Yankee abolitionist holiday, and that certainly antagonized certain Southern governors before the Civil War.
We only have a couple minutes left, so let me just ask you a general question here. You talk about Thanksgiving as a celebration of the family in the home, and that clearly has been it for perhaps a century. We've talked about going home for Thanksgiving. I'm thinking of a print in my own work from Currier and Ives, Home to Thanksgiving. How did going home come into this celebration of Thanksgiving?
Well, it was a custom in New England, among New Englanders, to, and I think that that's what that particular print represents, that at Thanksgiving, that would be a time when people who had grown up on these small homesteads and farmsteads would find a way home. Americans were mobile, but it would be a time of family. They would reconstitute themselves and really focus on that domestic world and what made it work. And we continue this tradition in many ways. The biggest travel time is right before Thanksgiving, where people move all about the country to try to reconnect with their families and their communities. And so I think that's a very important part of Thanksgiving.
And I hope people are listening to this show and listening to your comments as they're driving home for Thanksgiving. So we have to end it there. But Matthew, thank you for this interview and for the others we did during the year on America's civic holidays. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me, Brian. I really appreciate the sorts of questions you ask, filled with thought and intelligence, and you really bring out the best in those that you interview.
Thank you. And for those of our listeners who, like me, found this perspective on national holidays fascinating, I'd recommend Matthew Dennis's book, Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, An American Calendar, published by Cornell University Press. It's a book you'll be drawn back to every holiday to refresh your memory as to why we celebrate that particular holiday and why each holiday is important. This is Talking History.
For our site of the week, we're pleased to welcome back Kelly Shrum, Assistant Director of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. As a follow-up to our interview with Matthew Dennis on the history of Thanksgiving, Kelly tells us about a website where you can learn much more about the Pilgrims.
They frequently boil in this pottage fish and flesh of all sorts. These they cut in pieces, bones and all, and boil them in the aforesaid pottage. They are so dexterous to separate the bones from the fish in the eating thereof that they are in no hazard. This recipe for stew may have been served at the 1623 Thanksgiving, during which settlers attended church for 8 or 9 hours. A major feature of this site is its attempt to show how 20th and 21st century notions of the Thanksgiving holiday have more to do with Victorian values than strict historical traditions. Indeed, this site complicates ideas of Thanksgiving by showing visitors that the modern holiday celebrating community and family is a rather recent construction, while colonial New England Thanksgivings were distinctly religious experiences held irregularly by order of religious authority. Documenting the colonial experience of settlers in Plymouth, Massachusetts, this site contains 3 1,000-word articles on the Wampanoag Indians, as well as an essay on the British colonists of similar length. A major focus of the site is New England Thanksgiving. There are 4 essays narrating the event and explaining the menu, cooking techniques, and festivities. A myth and reality section debunks common misconceptions about the Pilgrims, including their average life expectancy and the average height and weight of colonists. A virtual tour of the Plymouth Plantation, which requires a free browser plugin, allows visitors to observe the grounds as well as historical reenactors and interpreters. To locate this site, visit historymatters.gmu.edu. Type Thanksgiving into the keyword search.
You've been listening to Kelly Shrum, Assistant Director of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. And finally, as promised, we begin a new series, a 10-part series, in fact, on some of the most curious episodes in history. They're drawn from Michael Farquhar's new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Great Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds, published by Penguin Books. Farquhar, a writer and editor for the Washington Post, has gathered 70 examples of these misdeeds and gathered them into 10 separate categories. Over the next 10 weeks, he will read from one selection from each section. This week, from the section he titles Super Dupers, Farquhar tells us about the escapades of swindler Oscar Hartzell.
One of history's most successful scam artists was a guy named Oscar Hartzell, who during the 1920s and early 30s convinced thousands of his fellow Midwesterners to hand him millions of dollars. He did it by claiming to be the Baron of Buckland, sole heir to the estate of Sir Francis Drake, the famed British buccaneer of the 16th century. Hartzell claimed the Drake estate, which didn't actually exist, was worth billions and included real estate extending from central London to South America. But it was all tied up in red tape, he said, and he needed investors to help him claim it from the British government. In exchange, he promised staggering returns. As the money poured in, Hartzell moved to London. There he could operate his scheme safe from U.S. law enforcement and eager investors alike. The one-time bankrupt lived lavishly. He dressed in the finest of suits, ate in the most expensive restaurants, and mingled with the English elite. Of course, without an actual Drake estate, it was impossible for Hartzell to give his investors anything but hope. He kept them at bay with promises that the great fortune was almost ready to be distributed. But first, there were complex audits and accounting procedures that needed to be completed. He reminded his backers that the estate was enormous, and that 3 centuries' worth of income and interest couldn't be sorted through overnight. As time went on, Hartzell became more and more inventive with his delay tactics. He plucked items from the newspapers of the day and incorporated them into a scheme. When the King of England was reported to be ill, for example, Hartzell told his investors that work on the estate couldn't continue until the king recovered. Amazingly enough, the money kept coming, in ever-increasing amounts. It was a boon time in America, and with vast fortunes being made, nothing seemed impossible. For those Midwesterners wary of Wall Street, the Drake estate appeared to be a safe and lucrative investment, and the stock market crash of 1929 only seemed to deepen their faith. "They now believe in Hartzell with the fire of the most rabid religious fanatics," one observer wrote. Hartzell's worshipful dupes continued to believe, even after he was deported from Britain and arrested in America. They continued to invest throughout his trial and subsequent incarceration, convinced that their hero was being railroaded by jealous officials who never invested. Hartzell was remarkably successful, but prison took its toll and he gradually lost his mind. He died in a prison hospital in 1943, reportedly convinced that he really was the Baron of Buckland and worth billions.
You've been listening to Michael Farquhar reading from his new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds, published by Penguin Books. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beattie is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need to do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau, wishing you a very pleasant Thanksgiving.